apologize for forgetting to turn my recorder on today. Just missed half the lecture. So there's sort of another way that atoms can stick together. One way to think of them is that they are sort of a region of positive charge surrounded by sort of a region where you have lots of negative charge. Oops. And sometimes what will happen is they'll basically share an electron such that that electron more or less acts as a partner in houses in each of the atoms simultaneously. And a way to sort of think of that is you end up with a situation where their electrons will sort of overlap. And so you might have had a vacancy in a house orbital for each of these atoms, and now they effectively overlap, and they have paired, each of them will then have a pair of electrons in that particular orbital. And one of the things to notice is that if you have this sort of thing, a way to think about this is that you now can have a stable system where I have positive charge and positive charge here, which if you get much closer, they'll want to repel. But you now have a large amount of electron density in the middle, so you have a lot of negative charge in the middle, which is sort of pulling the two nuclei in toward the middle. So if they get much closer together, you have less electron charge in the middle, and the positive charges are closer together, and so they'll be pushed apart. If you pull them apart, the positive charges are now further apart, they're less repelling, and you now have more electron density, which is negative, which is sort of pulling them together. So you end up with a situation where it's a little bit like you've got these two nuclei attached to a screen. They can't get too close together or too far apart. And this is another type of chemical bond. And this one is called the covalent bond. So basically you can then look at all the different atoms that are out there, and it turns out that there are a whole slew of them, if you can read them. We know of something on the order of, this is 103, we think there may be several more now, but there's a particular number here. That number corresponds to how many protons are in the nucleus. And how many protons in the nucleus basically then determines the available houses when you solve Schrodinger's equation, because it determines it's how tightly they're held, if you want to think about it. And then, because a neutral atom has the same number of electrons as it does protons, it also tells you for a normal atom how many of these states you have to fill. And you've sort of seen that as you go up in energy, you're going up into these more complex states. They're further away. They may be spatially angular, have angular characteristics, all sorts of strange things. And as you have more electrons, because you can't just glom them all into the lowest energy state, they have to fill all these weird states as you go up. And so what that means is that every one of these different atoms has very different chemical characteristics because how the electrons populate the shells and how the orbitals and how tightly those orbitals are held is determined by basically how many protons are in the middle and how many electrons there are, and they're all different. So that is shown in what's known as the periodic table of the elements that you've probably seen many times. If you're a chemistry major, you would have to basically learn to eat, breathe, and sleep this. And the reason is because it encapsulates a lot of information. It turns out that when you look at those orbitals and you start to fill them with different numbers of electrons, ones where you have single electrons that are sort of held fairly far out, that is fairly easy to remove, happen to lie in this column. So this would be the ground state of hydrogen, where I just have one electron sitting there. And remember that I can then pair that one off, and then I have to have one that goes up to the next shell, which is further out and is unpaired. So that means element number one is very reactive because I can pull that electron off easily. Element number two has the two electrons paired off. Energetically, they're very happy, and they're held fairly tightly, and that's helium, and that doesn't react with anything, really. It's a very happy element. If you add now one more, you have a very reactive element, which is known as lithium, which is, again, explosive in water. So hydrogen, lithium, sodium, krypton, these are all very reactive elements, and it basically comes right out of the solutions that the Schrodinger display. These are ones where you basically fill the available houses at a certain level, and all the electrons are paired off, and these atoms are almost not reactive at all with anything. So helium and neon and argon and krypton are very unreactive. So one of the reasons you use helium balloons and you can breathe the helium and everything is because it's unreactive. It's not going to rip your lungs up, stuff like that. It also has a lower density than air, so if you do it, it sound like Donald Duck when you talk. But I wouldn't do the same thing with hydrogen. Or I wouldn't get anywhere near lithium. So, any rate, I hope I haven't bored the bejesus out of all of you trying to give you chemistry 101 in a half hour or less. But the idea is that we can take the fact that electrons are waves, solve the wave equation, and out pops chemistry. Yeah.
So at one time you said that physicists believed that they had solved everything. Now, were the chemists aware that they had many questions at that time that they had answers for? So a chemist would have argued at the time, we have much to learn.
Well, I mean, you can piss a chemist off or a biologist off if you're an American physicist by saying, you know, Dirac basically did say publicly, you know, once we solved the hydrogen atom, he said, and I think I may have the quote in Visions because I love the quote, but I don't remember it exactly now. But he basically said, and now we have solved chemistry. And so at a conceptual level, I think that's sort of true. But I hope I've made you realize that when you add all these different things together, calculating it is not so. I mean, what you can really just calculate analytically would be what you get if you have a nucleus and a single electron. So in fact, you can do that. You can do that for uranium, you can do it for hydrogen. It's just, you know, you have to remove all the other electrons. The problem is uranium generally doesn't exist in nature with just a single electron. It usually has like 92 of them. So that's not particularly practical. So conceptually, it's true. You sort of have this idea. Things get a little more complicated because I'm sort of saying, well, picture the hydrogen houses and we just populate the houses. Well, the problem is, as I begin to populate the inner houses, the outer houses see less electric charge. So they're actually screened. So life is more complex. So it's not quite as simple as I say here. So actually understanding in detail the behavior is a more complicated thing than what you're doing here. But in principle, chemists do take quantum mechanics and effectively put it on computers and do numerical simulations of lots of different types of chemicals. I mean, they do this. There's an interesting thing out of this. I mean, and then you take it to another extreme when you say, well, chemistry is nothing more than a rearrangement of the electrons in these orbitals, which you basically understand conceptually. And then you say, well, we're, you know, dogs are nothing but chemicals interacting. So in principle, you can understand a dog this way, right? So one of the fabulous things about nature that I really think we don't understand at all is the fact that you get emergent properties, like consciousness. Where does that come from? So clearly, plugging something in Schrodinger's equation isn't sufficient. Or our knowledge of things in complex systems is certainly not sufficient to be able to give us an understanding of these emergent properties. Yeah.
Do emergent properties come out of computational models?
I think in some cases, yeah. I mean, it's not that physicists don't study these things or that people don't study complex systems. They do, and with some luck and some hard work and lots of computation, I think you can sort of see emergent properties come about in some cases. But it's tough business, and I think there's a whole host of emergent properties that we really don't understand very well. So, and you get some really neat things. I mean, people do, if you want to understand biology, you have to understand proteins, and proteins are these chemicals that have repetitive chunks, which we call peptides, amino acids, or whatever. And, you know, you can just look at the sequence and make some sense of it, but the truth is it now will fold in three dimensions so that you minimize, effectively you have a net minimum in the energy of how the various atoms are all associated with one another. And that folding can be incredibly complex, and it adds completely new degrees of freedom that, you know, you really don't have in your initial thinking of the system. So it's extremely complex business. So in spite of, you know, the basic physicist's arrogance, there's good reason for chemists and biologists to exist and do their thing, or we'll never understand a dog. But in principle, if you have infinite computing power, you ought to be able to basically throw these things together and understand how it works. In practice, that's not the case. And the truth is, in principle, it's really not quite like that easy either, because quantum mechanics has within it some inherent limitations that we're about to talk a lot about, because that's where quantum mechanics gets really strange. So let me stop here for a moment. Do you have any thoughts or questions about 2 years of chemistry being crammed down your throat in 20 minutes?
So we've been learning quantum mechanics and chemistry.
Quantum mechanics, chemistry. Yeah, you're getting a lot in this class. We're glossing. Yeah, it's like a mini PhD. Actually, a mini two or three PhDs. That's right. Okay. What I'd like to do is to step back a little bit and look at quantum mechanics. I guess I want to start talking about what we literally call quantum weirdness. And I think why we call it that will become obvious before long. When we solve this equation, Schrodinger's equation, we literally solve for the form, the mathematical form and energy of this function. This function has some spatial, that's what this of x means. It means it has spatial dependence. And so you saw when we looked at the hydrogen atom that you have a lot of different discrete solutions and they have different spatial dependencies, different energies. That's what we solve for. there's a very strange problem in all of this, and that is I may have missed a piece of this equation. It turns out that when you solve for psi, it is complex. And when I say complex in this way, I do not mean difficult to understand, although it is that as well. What I mean is that it contains within it the square root of minus 1. So it is a complex. It is a function that is complex. So if you may recall at some point getting annoyed in high school when they were dragging you through imaginary numbers. And I know certainly I was sitting there going, why are we doing this? This makes no sense to me at all. It turns out that it's quite a branch of mathematics, and it's very interesting. But the problem is, if you have an imaginary number, it's not well defined in the real world. That is, when you solve for psi itself, it doesn't correspond to reality because it's mathematically imaginary. So I might have it, it may be a sine function or something which you might think corresponds to something in the real world, but it's multiplied by this little I, the square root of minus 1, which means it's imaginary, which means I don't even know what that, I don't even know what to make of that in the real world. So psi, in the mathematics that you have to pull together in order to make it work for these massive waves, turns out not to be well defined. Psi squared is, if I take the square root of minus 1 times the square root of minus 1, I just get minus 1, which is something we know how to handle. So it turns out that if you ask, what are we solving for here? You're solving for the wave function, but I don't know what to do with the wave function itself. It turns out that is not something you can observe at all. What is well-defined and what was proposed by a guy named Max Born . He was a German, and he lived from 1882 to 1970, actually. And what Max said was that, look, this psi of x, I don't know what to do with it, but psi squared corresponds to the probability of finding the particle in that state. So if I were to, so the pictures that you saw of these different orbitals for the hydrogen atom really were pictures of psi squared. So those different what you see is different intensity colors in three dimensions, and you can think of this as numerically what psi squared is when you take that particular solution of the hydrogen atom and you then square that wave function, that psi, and you ask how does that get pictured in space, you end up with things that are shaped like this. What the colors mean is that would correspond to a larger psi squared. So the probability of finding the particle there where it is bright is much higher. So for example, you're most likely to find, if the particle happens to be in this quantum state, you are most likely to find it close to the nucleus, and there's some probability you see of finding it outside the nucleus. Because when I square the wave function, I get, you know, some spherically symmetric shell out here, but it has, it's sort of a psi square is sort of low, so the probability of getting it out there is small. The probability is much higher in toward the sun. That's what quantum mechanics can give you, is probability of being in a certain state. I solve for psi square, I can get the probability. But what it cannot tell me is, if I think of the electron as a particle, it cannot tell me anything about where it is inside that state. All I get is a probability distribution of where it is. Okay. So let us look at a different example, maybe one that's a little bit easier to picture. One of the things that we learned about waves is that if I take waves, so let's think of it as a photon or an electron, they both have wave-like properties, and let's say that I have a beam of the one or the other headed toward a slit. What we learned was, if I make that slit narrow enough, I will get diffraction. And we saw that with water waves. So what it means is that, let me stick with light for the moment. What it means is that as it goes through the slit, it gets spread out. So what this would mean was that if I have let's say some photographic film here. If the slit is wide, the light is not diffracted, and what I would see is a fairly sharp shadow of the slit right here. I would expose that part of the film. You okay with that? As I narrow the slit so that the slit is on the order of the size of the wavelength of the light, then what we've seen is that waves diffract, that is, they spread out. So what will happen then is I will get a light distribution where, if I make this a measure of the intensity, I'll get something that is most intense roughly where the slit is, but it will tail off. So you'll basically take what was a very sharp image and sort of spread it out. And it's brightest at its center, but it fades out as it goes. And there's a laser, the light is very focused. I now put it through a single slit. And what you see is that it's sort of spread out that way. So that's diffraction. Okay? So I sort of want to study this thing again. And I'm going to call the position along the film, I'll call that X. And we're only going to look in the plane of the board. And now, instead of having a beam of light, which then spreads out and gives me a nice image that's all spread out on the film, what I would like to do is to have a gun here, some sort of a device that sends out one photon or one electron at a time. Only one. So I can turn the intensity of the laser down to the point that it's a single photon being emitted, or if you'd like, a single electron. It's sort of the same in a way. What do you think you would see then? Well, I can't. If I have just one photon, when that hits the film, it gives you one bright spot. It can't do anything else. Because when it interacts with film, it interacts as a particle. It causes a chemical change at one point on the film. Yeah.
Distribution, when you look at each photon together, it still acts as a wave.
Okay, so, when we solve the Schrodinger's equation, what we get is psi squared. Psi squared gives a probability distribution for how these photons or electrons will be distributed along the film. What psi squared gives us is just what we would measure, or measured when we had a beam. It gives us this distribution that looks something like that. So what happens is that if I have a single photon go through the slit, it will interact with the film, okay? But I can't tell you where. It will just interact somewhere, so I'll get an interaction there. The next photon comes through. It'll interact somewhere. I have no idea where on the film because psi spreads across the film. Oh, I might get it here. The next one might interact here. The next one might interact here. Over the course of an hour or two, when I have lots of them, what you will find is that most of them will effectively interact in this region, and I'm letting them sort of act as probability now. They would all be in the plane of the film. But what you would find is that in time, after I have thousands and thousands of photons, I would get the same pattern on the screen that I would have if I had a beam of light, very intense. And that pattern would be the diffraction pattern. Okay? So quantum mechanics is powerless to tell you what's happening with the individual thing. So it's very different from Newtonian physics, right? Newtonian physics, I have this thing, I know what forces it's undergoing, I tell you where it shows up. Okay? And all of them basically do the same thing. Now you've got this weird sort of wave thing, and it's worse than that, because what's happening is as it goes through the slit, it's a wave. It diffracts. I know that. When it interacts with the film, it basically acts like a particle, because it has to interact at some point on the film. So we're sort of mixing apples and oranges here a little bit. But quantum mechanics cannot tell me where on the film any individual photon will interact. It can only give me the overall distribution of how they would be if I had many. You okay with that? It can tell me, for example, the individual photon coming through, I know it is most likely to interact with the film right here, but there is a non-zero probability that it's out here as well. So that's what quantum mechanics tells me. That didn't work out very well, did it? Okay, we'll try this again. Here's my film. And let's say I now have my single photons coming around, or my single electrons. What do I know? I know that psi square tells me that the electron can interact with that kind of probability distribution on the film. So, if I want to look at this propagating electron or this propagating photon, I can imagine it has a wave function, and I want to look at that wave function as a function of time. This wave function must, the square of it, must give you this distribution by the time it propagates to the film. Okay? So the wave function must have within it the possibility that this single particle will interact somewhere on that film. And that region of space is spread out spatially. Okay? And within the framework of quantum mechanics, I know nothing about where that electron is going to actually interact. So all of the possibilities have to be encoded in that wave function all the way up to the point where it interacts. Then it interacts. At the very instant that it interacts, the wave function is very different. The wave function is like a spike. If it interacts, say, here, then the wave function now, mathematically, is a probability of 1 at the actual point where the electron or the photon hit the film and caused the chemical reaction. If you look at this process, what psi has to be doing is psi has to be have this large spatial extent up until the very instant of interaction, and at that instant, the function becomes this probability of 1 at that point. And that happens instantaneously at the moment that interaction happens. And I hope that bothers you. Because this whole idea of instantaneous things doesn't make a lot of sense. We could imagine that this is 100 yards away from the film. And this is really, really wide. How in the world does some place on the film over here know that this particle all of a sudden interacted there? It would take the speed of light times this distance to even convey that information. So if you think of psi as real, this breaks causality. So if you take psi as something that's very real, then you have to have, within the framework of quantum mechanics, when an actual interaction happens, the wave function, that is this description of probability, collapses or changes form instantly, which is really bizarre. And it's very bothersome. So we call that wave function collapse. The wave function collapses instantly. Thank you. Okay, so think about where I want to take you on this next. There's an example that sort of brings this to light in a fairly outlandish way. Imagine if we have a particle that can decay into two photons. Photons have spin. And you can actually measure the direction of their spin when you detect the principle. So let us suppose that this particle can decay into two photons. So it's there, and then it disappears, and it goes into two photons that come off back to back. And let us say that the particle starts out with zero spin, so the sort of conserved spin, which turns out we do, the photons would have to come off such that their spins add up to a spin of zero. So you could either have this photon oriented with a spin this way, and this one oriented with a spin that way, or you could have this one that way, and this one that way. Okay? But the physical situation we're setting up is such that you have to have either this or that as the light goes away. It just is how we're setting some, the particles that we've chosen are just like. I don't know which it is. Quantum mechanics allows both solutions with 50% probability. Okay? Photons are emitted. They go large distances. Alright? What I know is that if I detect the photon over here and it's like this, this one was like that. If I detect the one over here and it's like this, this one was like that. In quantum mechanics, we say that they're an entangled state because they're not independent. When I'm either getting this or I'm getting that and nothing else. So now let's think about the quantum mechanical description. The wave function that mathematically then describes these photons, and this could be 1,000 miles away, okay? The wave function that describes these photons has a 50-50 probability that when I detect this one, it will be like this, or it'll be like that. But the very instant that I detect this one like this, I know what that one was. It collapses the wave function. And this can be thousands of miles, and it happens instantly. That's what quantum mechanics is telling me. And this is very bothersome. I'll give a more detailed slide, you know, next time. It's called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. Because basically, you're saying that the information as to what happens over here somehow is conveyed over here instantly. And that's crazy. I think it was Einstein. I think it was Einstein who said this is spooky action at a distance. It's not science. That's breaking causality. It's sort of crazy. So it's very, very bothersome. And this is fundamentally part of quantum mechanics. This way of looking at quantum mechanics is called the Copenhagen interpretation. And it explicitly has within it this instantaneous collapse of the wave function, which has spooky action at a distance inherent in it. So, if you're a Copenhagenist, you say, well, I don't know that I really care about that, because in the end, all I see is what I detect, and I never detect psi. So why should I be bothered that psi changes instantly? I can never detect it. What I see is psi squared. I only see what I detect. And so, in a sense, you literally take what's bothering you and you sweep it under the carpet. And you ignore it because you don't actually observe. I cannot see psi per se. All I can see is the end product. And somehow, I get that right with the probability. So, this is very scary and bothersome. And I think in some of your reading this week, I have something where Bohr and Einstein it's a New York Times article describing how they're disagreeing about this. Because this, Einstein being a famous example of somebody who was really bothered by this, and basically said, quantum mechanics can't be all there is because this just can't be how it is, right? You have to have some reason behind it. You can't have a spooky action of existence. So, in another article, it describes something called many worlds. We'll certainly come back to this, but let me give you a sense of it. In many worlds theory, you say that, oh, the wave function isn't just this photon, okay? There is a huge wave function that describes all of reality. And it evolves smoothly with time. And I happen to have a decay, and in one part of the wave function, I have this, and in the other part of the wave function, I have that. And if you're in the part of the wave function where you basically see this, you don't see that. If you see this, you don't see that. And so a way to think about it is that you have this much larger wave function that basically contains within it all the different possible threads of reality that you could observe in quantum mechanics. And if you have that, you completely avoid the need for wave function collapse. And so this is called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics because it basically says that anything that quantum mechanically is possible happens within that wave function. And all that happens for you as the observer is that you're only seeing one thread of that. But all the rest is there. And so this now is one of the multiple universes that we're talking about. So we'll come back to this. But it's very strange stuff. I'm out of time. Any questions, comments? I hope that makes you look forward to some of the reading. Yeah.
I have a question about today's question. Are you talking about those three people, Einstein, Zener, individually, we call them, or all three of them together?
We usually call this particular thing the EPR. I think they published a paper together where they were.
Okay, so all three of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, we're starting to get into certifiably really strange stuff now. So I hope you enjoy your reading this week.